This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon, this is Earth Matters on The Bigger Picture, and I'm Juliet Jacobs. With the recent announcement of the 12th Malaysia Plan, we're going to dissect the key points of the environmental agenda under the blueprint with Meenakshi Raman, the president of Sahabat Alam Malaysia, and discuss whether the proposed strategies will be sufficient to brace the impact of climate change, reduce the emission of greenhouse gases, while protecting factors of economic growth and development in Malaysia. Welcome, Meena. How are you today?
I'm fine, Juliet.
Always a pleasure to have you on the show, Meena. So I know I made you go through this. Of course, you went through the document yourself, but you know, thank you so much for going through it for us. How pleased are you with the environmental protection measures that have been cited in the 12th Malaysia Plan?
I must say that I did not expect some of the focus on advancing sustainability. I think what's welcome is to see that this is one of the thrusts of the way in moving forward. I mean, there's an emphasis on advancing sustainability and also talking about the green economy or green growth and green financing. So I think the realization has been that you have to integrate much more the environment into the economic and the social pillar. There's a lot of emphasis on sustainable development goals, but usually, the economy takes priority, the environment is left behind, mm-hmm. and the social impacts also are sometimes left behind. Or sometimes what will be argued is that you need to provide more jobs, therefore you need the economy to take precedence, and then the environment becomes a side effect. But what was interesting to see in the 12th Malaysia Plan is this is quite refreshing, actually, to see that environment is front and center in terms of advancing sustainability. So that's a welcome measure. And many of us were very surprised by the Prime Minister's announcement about carbon neutrality, yes, by 2050. Of course, as my usual line is, the devil is always in the detail, but at least there is some indicator that we are looking at the green aspects, because it's not just as a greenwash or a sideline, but we are actually bringing in into the mainstream a lot more understanding that the environment is very important in terms of sustainability. So that's quite refreshing. So I think it's welcome in that sense.
Mm-hmm. And if we can just quickly look at, you know, the 11th Malaysia Plan, right? Do you think there's a lot of difference between the two plans? You know, I think in the 11th Malaysia Plan, there was a lot of emphasis on the environment, on climate change, adaptation, all of that, right? What are your thoughts on the differences between the two?
Yeah, I think it is fair to say that some of these aspects of the environment are not new. They have been there. The green growth, the so-called green growth strategy itself was already there. But I think the 12th Malaysia Plan itself acknowledges the fact that there have been some failures in advancing that agenda. Mm-hmm. Actually, they put this in the context of the 2030 agenda, which is actually the United Nations agenda with sustainable development goals as a very important aspect of that. So the 12th Malaysia Plan acknowledges that the 11th plan was off chart on some of these aspects. For instance, 5 targets, they say, that have not shown significant progress. One of them is the formulation of environmental protection legislation, renewable energy install capacity, managing the demand, the development of a demand side management master plan. This is on the energy side. Mm-hmm. They did not manage to do it. The gazetting of terrestrial and inland water, as well as coastal and marine areas as protected areas. So some of these targets were not met, actually. And they also say that there was a slow uptake of projects and underperformance in terms of renewable energy install capacity uptake. So they do acknowledge that some of the problems were there. And also on environmental governance, that they do acknowledge that more ought to have been done. So it's good that there was some reflection of that. And And then moving forward, how do we strengthen it and not repeat the mistakes of the 11th plan?
Yeah. If you had to give it a grade, what would you have given it?
A grade for the 11th plan?
Yeah, for the 11th plan.
Achievement? Well, very hard to give a grade.
Okay.
Because, you know, you always want to encourage the student to do better, right?
So, okay, fair enough.
So, I mean, and I think acknowledging the fact that the incoherence before needs to be much more coherent. Mm-hmm. Because, for instance, on the one hand, we talk about improving the public transport and so on in the 11th Malaysia plan, and even acknowledging green mobility, you know, nice words. But then we have pushed the car policy,
yeah,
you know, so yeah, really private car ownership. And I think that fundamentally throws out of whack what you want to do in terms of green mobility. So I think the issue really is one of coherence and whether all the other policies actually bolster the coherence in that direction. But I am hopeful that coherence will be much more in the 12th Malaysia plan implementation. I think that's a fundamental point. And many people have said that while we welcome what's in the 12th Malaysia plan, I mean, nice words, you know, circular economy, I can elaborate a bit more about that, green investments,
yeah,
environmental, social governance, nice buzzwords. I mean, these are all climate friendly and low carbon and this, that, and the other. But the issue really is, are we going to be translating them into real plans of action that will be implemented? I think that therein lies the challenge. And fundamental to this is the environmental governance, the federal-state relationship. I mean, you can cut it any way. We will always come back to the problem of how does the federal manage to rein in the states because
yeah,
if land, forests, river, water resources, much of it is in the hands of the states in terms of their management. We've gone through this over and over again. So that's one of the aspects that's going to be very, very challenging. So to what extent will the federal government actually ensure that this 12th Malaysia Plan policy makes sure that the states are going to be complying with the direction that they are taking?
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. And yeah, I guess that remains to be seen, isn't it? But let's dissect this 12th Malaysia plan. Green growth, that was the government's buzzword back in 2015. It continues to be used in this current 12th plan under theme 3 of advancing sustainability, which, as they say, and I'm quoting here, focuses on advancing green growth as well as enhancing energy sustainability and transforming the water sector. So that's a lot there, Mina. Do you think you can help unpack that a little bit for us?
I think the three things that they did highlight that needed to be addressed in this plan was unsustainable consumption and production practices. I think that's really key. The circular economy idea that has come now,
mm-hmm,
I think that's very important because, you know, they acknowledge the fact that Malaysia has been following what's called a linear economy. And they even explain that what that means is that you make and you dispose.
Yeah.
So there isn't, the environment is externalized, meaning you can continue to dispose of and behave as if the natural environment is, you know, you make disposable products and then you throw it out.
Mm-hmm.
And there is no concern for issues of sustainability and so on. So I think what's positive here in terms of addressing that, in terms of consumption patterns and productions. I think for us, that's very, very important. We in Sabat Alam have been talking a lot about consumption patterns, lifestyles, production systems. So it's quite heartening to note that in this 12th Malaysia plan, in the way of moving towards sustainability, they are promoting what's called the circular economy concept. Now, this actually has come from the European countries and so on.
Yeah.
So it's good to see that we are beginning to pay attention to this. And what that basically means is, and they have the 12th Malaysia Plan actually has a nice description about what this means. And they talk about the approach is not about take, make, use, and dispose which is the linear economy,
yeah.
but rather reduce, reuse, recycle, resource efficient, long-term use and multiple life cycles. That means you don't build in obsolescence, because for the longest time, companies would make things that you use and throw, use and throw. And so, you know, that's to make profit going. Mm-hmm. So from disposable toothbrushes, now why on earth do people want to use disposable toothbrushes, disposable this, disposable that? So all these are really problematic. And the issue of making sure that the businesses themselves begin to look at the circular economy so that you actually close the loop. So when you are producing something, you should be already be paying attention to, are you recycling? Are you reusing? Are you remanufacturing? Are you making sure that this is sustainably done so that you minimize waste and you minimize the use of materials itself?
Okay.
But one fundamental point I have to stress here is that while we talk about the circular economy and the production being much more sustainable, what is not addressed is actually the kind of products you should be producing. I mean, that's not discussed. And for us, coming from the perspective of Sabah Dalam Malaysia, we actually do need to look at what is it that we are producing. So it's not just about producing them sustainably, but whether we even need them. For instance, I'm not a big fan of electric vehicles for private cars. I mean, there's a lot of emphasis on, you know, Tesla, and, you know, I buy a private vehicle and charge batteries, and, you know, it's like luxury. It's actually a luxury. Car is actually a luxury. More so an electric vehicle, private ownership will be a luxury. So it's not about producing luxury items. I think the whole issue of sustainability, while you recognize that much of the material goods come from the environment, services come from the environment, we are using nature's capital, they use the term nature's capital.
Yeah.
All that is right. But are we producing good things? For instance, even in housing, are we producing affordable housing or are we doing elite housing? You know, building more and more big, super condos and projects that are unnecessary. So I think all this needs to be re-looked at. What is it that we are producing? What is it that we are consuming? Do we really need it? And I think that is not mentioned here, but we have to advocate and agitate for that kind of thinking. Because I recall that, even in the West, they talk so much about energy efficiency and circular economy,
yeah.
but they don't see what they are producing. For instance, you see the mobile phones. Of course, we are all dependent on the mobile phones, and the technology keeps moving up and up and up. But getting rid of these from all the batteries and the electrical gadgets and the, you know, we all rely on them. But what happens is that they move so fast. After you buy one more iPhone, you have to throw away after a few years and buy another one. So that's not sustainable. So I do think that we need to revisit some of these assumptions of what is really needed. And if we are really serious about the circular economy, it has to also be very important to focus on what is it that we are producing, what is it that we are consuming. So that's an important aspect, as I see. Then finally on that is that the extended producer responsibility, meaning it's not for us just to talk about recycling. You know, we take the plastic back and then we say, you know, we'll try and recycle, and then after that it goes into the landfill. So if the business is going to produce that kind of a thing, of a product, they have to bear the responsibility right from the beginning. Mm. Whether it's going to go into your landfill, it shouldn't go into your landfill. Don't produce if you can't recycle or reuse. So those are fundamental changes which are important. So that's one aspect. Maybe you want me to focus on other aspects?
Yes, we'll just go for a quick break now, Mina. And when we come back, maybe we can talk about the energy and water sectors. Yeah. So I'm speaking today to Meenakshi Raman. She's the president of Sahabat Alam Malaysia. She's helping us to dissect what has been in what's been said in the 12th Malaysia Plan with regard to environmental sustainability. We'll come back and discuss that after this quick break. You're listening to Earth Matters on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Welcome back. This is Earth Matters on the Bigger Picture. I'm Juliet Jacobs. Joining me on the line today is Meenakshi Raman. She's the president of Sahabat Alam Malaysia, and she's joining us today to help dissect the 12th Malaysia Plan and what it has to say about environmental sustainability. So, you know, as we were discussing before the break, Meena, theme three in the plan says that we need to advance sustainability and we need to focus on advancing green growth and energy sustainability and transforming the water sector. Can we focus on those last two? You know, enhancing energy sustainability and the transforming the water sector. What are the main focus areas or shall we say challenges faced in those sectors?
I think if you take water, I think that's a very important key recognition that we definitely need to enhance the conservation of water resources. So that's important. I mean, there has been this discussion about integrated, water resources management. But yeah. The one step further to that, which the plan acknowledges, is actually to gazette and protect water catchment areas.
Yes.
And this they have stressed. And they say it will be intensified. And they also talk about riparian forests and wetland habitats will be conserved and protected because they do link to water resources. Also, they are linked to managing disaster risks from climate change and other events. So they talk about integrated river basin management. This is something that we've been, it's a one step further from the water resources management to river basin management. Mm. Because what you actually need to look at is states cannot be looking at their forests or ecosystems only in their states. Mm. Many of these are actually coming from shared ecosystems. Yeah. Like the central forest spine, all the rivers that flow through the central forest spine, which is really the backbone of the country, where you have shared resources, whether it's between Kedah, Penang, Perak, Kelantan, you know, that same water flow, the water towers, which come from there. Yeah. So there needs to be coherence in terms of how you manage that resource, and it cannot be left to the states independently. So this integrated management is so important. So they actually talk about strengthening water resource governance. I think this has been quite a political hot potato because it's about federal interfering, or that's what is seen as federal interference with state sovereignty over the use of forests and water catchments and so on. So importantly, they do mention that the governance of water-related agencies at the federal level will be improved to strengthen the integrated water resources management. Some people have actually called for a single agency to manage that. Now, we don't see that reference here. I think this still political hot potato is still being worked on. But what is encouraging is that one of the things that I noticed in the 12th Malaysia Plan was this idea that before you de-gazette any forest, states must actually hold a public hearing. Yep. Now, that only exists in Selangor at the moment, under the forestry enactment of Selangor, as we saw in the Hulu Langat Forest Reserve issue. And so here, recognizing that all states must do this public hearing before de-gazetting is a step forward. But I would go one step further. And I think that it's not enough to leave it to the states because it talks about encouraging. Now, you can't force the states. But I think the federal government needs to go one step further. We have the National Forestry Enactment, National Forestry Act. That's a National Forestry Act. States have to apply it. So in the National Forestry Act itself, we should amend the Forestry Act, National Forestry Act, to provide for mandatory public, hearings and information about possible degazetting for whatever purpose. So that should be done at the federal level. And then you ask the states to apply it. Leaving it to the states and encouraging them to do it may not work because it is just a best effort, best endeavor. But I do think that if the state is really serious, the federal is very serious, then this is fundamental. Make it mandatory. Make it and ensure that the consultation process is actually not token, that it's actual consultation. because water governance, as we say, it always comes from the protection of the water catchment areas, mm-hmm. which is vital. And that is your forest and your mountains, actually, and your rivers. So that is something that we need to do. So that's on the water side. I think it's a governance issue. The other is on the issue of energy. Now, we were very happily informed when the Prime Minister actually said that coal will be phased out. We did not expect that. Many of us have been lobbying for coal phase out. So that's very encouraging. But at the same time, there are existing coal power plants which are not operationalized yet, or they are in the works. So we were quite disappointed that you know, the phase out is about the new coal power plants. It's not about existing ones which are not yet in operation, but are going to be operational. So that was a bit of a disappointment. But nevertheless, going forward, that's a good thing. But how are they going to make up for the you know, because we rely on coal quite a lot for energy, for electricity and so on. So how do we make that shift? Our concern is if it's going to go to, there's a lot of emphasis on gas. Yeah, mm-hmm. gas is still fossil fuel derived. And then there is emphasis on hydropower. Now we worry about big dams again. Is this going to be the resurgence of mega dams? Mm. And that, I think, is something that we have to relook. We are really about achieving sustainability. Some of these kinds of bigger dams and, you know, are problematic. And that is not the way to go forward. They may be classified as renewable, but it's very controversial. Because how many forests are you going to drown before, you know, when you make all these big dams? So that's an area of concern. But the direction is an important one, phase out coal. But over-reliance on gas is also going to be a problem. But what we definitely need to do is do much more on solar energy. And I think that will be our challenge. And this takes us to the issue of carbon neutrality. Yeah, the Prime Minister announced carbon neutrality by 2050.
That's right.
The 2050 number does not appear in the plan, but it appears in his speech.
That's right.
So that's interesting, but that's a good step forward. But again, how do you go carbon neutral? I mean, that is a challenge, right? How do you do that? And we in our current targets, we talk about 45%. Emissions intensity target. That means not absolute reductions, as we've talked over and over again. It's the emissions intensity based on GDP that we are looking at. So the higher the GDP, usually when you say you look at the gross GDP and carbon emissions, if your GDP goes up, your carbon emissions go up.
Yeah.
So here the idea is that how can you still do GDP up with emissions going down? And that really is the challenge. But I do think that, again, this is the devil will always be in the details. We talk about, I know, net zero. Many of these companies are now saying that we're going to go net zero. So our concern is really, as I've said before, is it really the real decarbonizing? That means, are you really making sure that you're no longer going to be emitting more emissions, but you're actually taking measures to reduce emissions. So that's decarbonizing. Or are you offsetting it? You keep doing the same emissions, but you are paying to buy, credits, carbon credits, because there is an announcement about carbon pricing. This is new also in the 12th plan about how to get to carbon neutrality. They talk about carbon pricing. Now, carbon pricing, there are two mechanisms, right? One is carbon tax. Now, in this climate, and especially next year is elections, no government is bold enough to go into an election year with a carbon tax, which would have been the right solution. And also, I think politically, there's no appetite for new taxes because companies and many sectors are recovering from COVID and so on. So the issue of energy price and all that becomes highly political, and politicians don't have the appetite to go that way. It'll be very unpopular. But hopefully it will, when, and they talk about a feasibility study that they will do in terms of a carbon tax by end of 2022. I think the elections will be over by then. So perhaps the government will be bolder to actually introduce a carbon tax so that you the high-end emitters are the ones that have to be penalized. Well, you don't penalize the lower income group. You have to make sure that this tax is progressive and that it doesn't unfairly impact the poor. If you recall, you know, the Yellow Vest movement in France, when Macron was trying to be very climate friendly and he introduced this removal of subsidies in the consumer subsidies, yeah. which led to the energy prices going up, which then caused this yellow, you know, movement of workers and all, I mean, many low-income people on the streets protesting. Same thing happened also in Chile when they introduced this. So we need to be very careful to ensure that we don't penalize the poor, but the high-end emitters. The other is the carbon pricing that you talk about is emissions trading. And for me, this is a major concern because we've never done this in this country before. Mm. It's new. Okay. The only emissions trading which is regulated is the European Emissions Trading Scheme. And even in the European Emissions Trading Scheme, what it basically means is that you have a cap on how much emissions as a whole in the country that you can, you know, you have to abide by and you cannot exceed that. So anybody who has emitting more will have to buy the carbon credit from those who are not emitting as much.
That's
so
right.
There's some kind of allowances and permits. And many of these methods were actually criticized as being, not real incentives, but they were actually making it easy for polluters to continue to pollute instead of doing the real hard decarbonizing. So in this country, I worry because all this kind of trading schemes will actually require a lot of regulation, a lot of verification, so that you don't, you know, you talk about producing one ton of carbon and you're going to buy a carbon credit of a one ton. Is that really verifiable? Mm-hmm. Are you? But more importantly, the fundamentals of emissions trading is that there is this belief that the offsets work. That if that, you know, as I've explained before, I fly on an airplane, I solve my conscience by paying for a tree that is planted somewhere, maybe in the forest in Malaysia, right?
Yep.
Same thing. You continue to pollute and then you offset it by paying some state to protect the forest. Now, the assumption here is that the emission, that one ton of CO2 that goes into the atmosphere will be absorbed by the tree automatically. So yeah. It doesn't function that way. The science of this is actually very, very flawed. So it's good in the accounting books. Mm. You can put it in the accounting books and you can say, oh, I emitted 10 tons and I removed 10 tons because I planted 5 trees. And so my balance sheet is fine. But it does not work like that in real life, in the science way. That's why many of us are very concerned about this emissions trading idea. Good for business to look good, but bad science from a science perspective. So the real way to actually go is to, again, do everything you can do to ensure that emissions don't continue, while at the same time, you increase your sinks, which is your forest, your wetlands, your grasslands, your mangroves, so that you actually, there is some kind of in the long term, there will be some kind of adjustment. Because all the impact that we see of climate change today is actually, according to the IPCC, we discussed this at some time ago,
yeah.
was historical emissions, much of it. So because CO2 remains in the atmosphere for a long time. So planting a tree today is not going to be absorbing the carbon that you emit today. It is for the future. So you have to decarbonize and you have to reforest. You have to do both. But the idea of carbon neutrality, again, how do you achieve that? That's really the we need to look at it in detail. Energy efficiency, there's a lot of mention here. I think that's a good way. We need to be much more energy efficient. That means the demand side management, which they failed to do well. The 12th Malaysia Plan acknowledges that they could not come up with this demand side management master plan. Mm-hmm. So do better on that so that you ensure that you actually manage the demand. So there's a lot more to do in making sure that these nice aspirations are actually translated to real action on the ground.
I think that is what a lot of us taking away from it, right? It's very aspirational in nature, the 12th Malaysia Plan. And I guess, you know, will there be enough monitoring mechanisms, you know, actual targets and timelines that are built into the plan, right? I mean, do you think this 12th Malaysia Plan can actually be a real game changer for the environment?
It can, because I think it is at least these aspirations are important. Setting the direction is important. Internalizing them across. The one thing that you constantly see is the whole of nation approach, whole of nation approach.
Yeah.
You see that buzzword all across. I mean, it sometimes is very, you know, it's nice to talk about whole of nation approach, but what does that really mean in real terms? Yeah. I think the understanding, the coherence, again, back to the coherence. Of course, there is this notion of shared responsibility, that everyone has a shared responsibility, whether it's the consumer, whether it's the producer, whether it's the government. So it's not just the government's responsibility alone. Now, that much we accept, that it's not just the government, because usually people will say, government should ban la. Why they didn't ban? You know, I want to use, you know, proper material, but government not banning. Now, that's the kind of response you sometimes get. But that's not correct. You should be an enlightened consumer, an ethical consumer. At the same time, we talk about the ethical producer. Now, that's where the dilemma comes. Because when businesses actually, still by and large, the businesses are about making profit. You don't make profit, you go out of business. You don't compete. I mean, you are in a competing environment. If you don't do better than your neighbor, you're going to basically close shop.
Go on, Dan.
So a lot of it is actually sacrifice in terms of cost cutting and measures. And that's where the environment suffers. Labor practices suffer. These are the two sectors that will usually be compromised. You pay labor very poor wages. Huge demand for foreign labor in this country because they want to produce cheap and they want to maintain competitiveness. So when you begin to integrate environment and social aspects into the production system, it's not going to be cheap. It will be costly. So who is going to pay the cost of that? I think that's the conversation. And if we all acknowledge that we all need to be sustainable, then incentives, as I said, the green financing incentive is very, very important. You cannot assume that it will be done. And then there's also a concern that maybe the big guys will be able to, they can do ESG, this, that, and there, but the small guys won't be able to, like the medium, small scale enterprises. How do you make sure that they are also come on board with improved standards? And that, I think, the plan acknowledges that you do need to do a lot more of hand-holding and building and internalizing. And I understand that that's already beginning. So that's a good direction to go. So back to this, do they remain aspirations or do they really remain actions? I think in this aspect, the more the government does in terms of setting the framework, setting the norms, not just leaving it to guidelines. I mean, guidelines don't work.
Yeah.
And this is what is concerning me in terms of the mineral resources management. That's one aspect that, you know, I worry about in terms of policy coherence. And in fact, you do see in one part of the plan, when you talk about resetting the economy, emphasis is on mining, quarrying, construction. This is a serious environmentally degrading sector.
Mm-hmm.
Usually they are the most environmentally unfriendly. Construction may be better now, but then, you know, in terms of where the projects are allowed, do you just build everywhere? What kind of sustainability practices do you follow? All that is important. But in mining, I worry that there is emphasis here on, enhancing mineral resources management. Adoption of new technologies will be encouraged to enhance efficiency and monitoring of best practices in mineral exploration. So suddenly there's been a mineral revival. And this is very, very concerning. This is probably because of a lot of demand for products, like even in the renewable energy sector, even solar and so on, relying on rare earths. In the digital technologies, relying on you know, rare earth minerals, some radioactive, which will involve radioactive elements, some no. But these are the demand that is there right now. So in this country, there's suddenly been a boom again in looking at these mining areas. And unfortunately, so far that we have seen about two or three or four projects, when we look at the environmental impact assessment announcements, they have been in environmentally sensitive areas. Mm. So you talk about, they talk about standard operating procedures. Now, and then they talk about licensing conditions. Now, are all these enough? That's the idea is that, you know, businesses will behave, but businesses will never behave. They will continue to misbehave unless you really have the sticks. You can have the carrot and you have the stick, but you cannot be, you know, self-regulate. There's no such thing as self-regulation. It's a myth. And so government needs to come down hard on these things. So enforcement capability has to be high. So on this mining thing, the last thing I'll say is that we don't believe in really the sustainable mining. We've yet to see how mining can be really sustainable. We've yet to be convinced. Mm-hmm. And so we're very worried that, you know, because much of the mining has already been done in areas where there were a lot of minerals. Now you're going into the frontiers, whether it's your environmentally sensitive area. So we need to be very wary about that. So in terms of implementing action on the ground, I think what's really critical, there was one important aspect which was there, which is data. The one-stop center on environmental data, which will be made available to civil society organizations as well as the private sector. That's very key. Because much of the data that is we within the government, and we don't have access to that data. And we've been crying out loud for, you know, information to come through. How much of forest do we have left? How much of concessions have been given out? What areas have been protected? You know, important information like that, which are in the hands of government. So it's encouraging to see that there's one-stop environmental. It says that there will be a one-stop environmental-related data center will be improved and strengthened with sharing of data. Very, very critical. Because if you want to talk about this whole nation approach, you do need the check and balances. Yeah. You do need civil society to be more empowered. You need communities to be more empowered. And then, you know, when they talk about inclusive society, what I like is that the revival of strengthening local agenda 21. Many of us who came from the Rio days, the Earth Summit in 1992, one of the positive things was actually to devolve governance, and that devolved governance is at the local local council level. Unfortunately, much of that local council level, where a lot of decisions are made, whether the factory is going to be sited here or whether you're going to have an earthwork there or whether it's going to be a toxic facility next to your house, all that is local planning at the local level. But what is missing is really that much of the decision-making is in the hands of political appointees. Mm. There's been a call for elections at the local level. I don't think it'll ever happen, but that governance is important. But what is also key is that local agenda 21, while you wait for some reform in the elections at the local level, what's more important is actually reviving local agenda 21, where communities become engaged in whether it's river management, community farms. You know, there was talk also in the plan about developers and being encouraged when you build to have communal lands, spaces for people to do community farming, create sponge cities so that you're more green. So there's a lot of initiatives we are seeing that's happening by people's own efforts, yeah, not by government efforts. But if this is multiplied through local agenda 21, that's really fantastic. That means communities of concern who will all become environmental activists, empowering. They will be your eyes. They will be your watchdog. They will be your whistleblowers. So we need those, that's inclusive, where decision-making is actually not only by the powers that be. And usually the powers that be, as I've always said, the largest stakeholder is always the business. some lobby behind, some business behind, some developer behind. But I think that that has to go. So the environmental governance needs to be improved in that side. But critically, community empowerment, citizen empowerment, inclusive in terms of hearing their voices and not rubbishing them as, oh, this is another nuisance. Many of us are facing this. We are told that we are nuisance, we are anti-development, we are troublemakers, and we are not appreciated. But I think that attitude needs to go. Because if you're really about whole nation approach, and you know, a lot of buzzwords about family, Malaysia family.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, begin to pay attention to the voices and the needs of those people in society who don't have any vested interest and who don't put profits first. We are not about profits first. It's about people over profits. I think that's important.
Okay. All right. And I guess I'm afraid we're running out of time, Mina, but you know, any last recommendations that you'd like to make or anything that you think people really need to look out for in this 12th Malaysia plan? Are you hopeful, you know, for the next 5 years as well?
For me, I think fundamental is really a lot of awareness raising. I think there are good things here. This needs to be translated. And that translation and demand and agitation has to happen. And so recognition about environmental consciousness, even in schools, in curriculums, in you know, all from the bottom up right down. And until that happens, and I constantly say that politicians won't respond until they find that the voter base begins to make these demands very strongly and powerfully. And so I am hopeful. I think there are enlightened civil servants who actually want to see some of these, a lot of this go into advancing sustainability and so on. I think many of them also must be frustrated that they have a good policy, but policy is not implemented. So I do think that there's a lot to do. And I am hopeful, but at least there's a good direction that is set. Correct the wrongs and improve the right. And I think we hopefully 5 years later we'll come back and say, hey, this plan actually delivered much more and did not underperform.
Mm-hmm. And any last thoughts on, you know, you mentioned coherence a lot, right? I think that's something that we really need to see happening, especially with this Malaysia plan as well, right?
Yeah, there's much more coherence in this plan than in the previous plans because there was a lot of silo. One hand you promote car ownership, Malaysian car policy, and then the other you talk about green mobility. It's really incoherent. Yeah. Now they haven't done away with the car policy. But there is definitely a much more focus on green mobility and public transportation and so on. But having said that, I think one aspect that has not been taken into account seriously is the when we look at the economic chapter, a section of the 12th Malaysia Plan, there is a recognition that we need to have much more engagement with free trade agreements. Mm. Now, many people are not aware about the implications of free trade agreements on sustainability and on the environment. So the environmentalists will look at the environmental chapter. Many of the business communities look at the free trade agreements and what they will do. So one of the concerns we have is actually the CPTPP. It's called the Comprehensive and Progressive Agreement for Trans-Pacific Partnership. And the problem here is that it is actually a very pro-investor policy, foreign investor policy. It's very encouraging of foreign investors' rights, which is actually not necessarily a good thing. And one of those aspects is that foreign investors, and the term investment means even if you open a post box in the country, that's an investment. It's not the physical presence of the investor. Uh-huh. So the definition of investment in the CPTPP is very, very broad. Like I said, you open a post box, you don't have physical presence, you're already classified as an investor. And if then one of the clauses in the investment chapter of the CPTPP is that if there is any policy that the government makes, which will be unfair, fair and equitable treatment. Fair and equitable treatment means the investor has to be treated fairly. So if you change the policy environment, and you can change the policy environment in this way, for instance, you want to, like Angela Merkel in Germany wanted to phase out nuclear power plant. She was actually sued by a nuclear power company who said that you have affected my profits and my future profits and sued Germany for that. And that's the investor-state dispute. So you have businesses like that, investors like that. We have to be very careful about. So the government has to be very, very careful in bringing, I mean, in there's a big discussion about whether to ratify or not. And we are incredibly concerned. And environmental groups and all the civil society groups, we are very, very worried that we are not paying attention to how all the good policies of the 12th Malaysia Plan, including on health, your other aspects, which is policy space, will be undermined when you have to be very pro-investor and when you have to a foreign investor and when you have and the likelihood of being sued for doing the right thing. So I think that that is a major policy incoherence and we have to pay attention to that.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you so much for joining me, Mina. And like you said before this, you know, hopefully in 5 years, you know, we will see everything that was outlined here actually come to fruition. And time is running out, isn't it? We do have to act. We were supposed to have acted 5 years ago or even before that. So let's hope there is some coherence and some actual action happening on the ground. Again, I guess, you know, if anyone would like to get in touch with you at Sahabat Alam Malaysia, just head to the website or follow you guys on social media. Yeah?
Yes. Of course.
Okay. All right. Well, my thanks again to Meenakshi Rahman, the president of Sahabat Alam Malaysia. She joined us to help unpack the 12th Malaysia Plan in terms of environmental sustainability that was outlined in that. If you miss any part of today's interview or any previous Earth Matters interviews, just download the podcast at bfm.my/earth or you can find it on the BFM app. This has been Earth Matters on the Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.